Thank you so much. Wow. It's great to be here, particularly after an introduction like that. Thank you. I think we have some things in common. You heard about LIPW, which is co-sponsoring today's event. One reason they're here is also a reason why I'm here. That organization was founded in part over frustration about the United States' rush to war in Iraq almost 10 years ago. It was that same episode that helped lead to my decision to quit the New York Times. And it was exactly for some of the reasons that that Sylvia just mentioned. Now that I'm finished as a newsman, which I did for some 20 years plus, I'm able to admit something that I probably would not have been able to admit then, which is that I'm really not interested in news. I used to get into some trouble about this in my newspaper because I sometimes believe that news is actually a distraction. We're so busy trying to understand what happened today, we fill our minds with that, and there's no room in our minds for two other things that are actually more important than what happened today. One is, what happened yesterday? How did we get here? Why is this happening? And the other is, what's going to happen tomorrow? What is the meaning of what just happened today? Those are a little more complex, and I think there are great forces in our media culture and our wider culture that discourage us from thinking about that, and they fill our minds with a lot of nonsense about what's just happening right now, as if the events of this hour are all we need to think about. Actually, I once had a colleague of mine on the foreign desk in New York, one of my spies up there, tell me a story that he said he overheard this conversation between two of my editors. They were going over one of my stories, and one said to the other, "Do you think Kinzer will ever write a story about something that happened less than 100 years ago?" I like that, though. I took that as a kind of a compliment. During the run-up to the Iraq War, I was working for the New York Times, and this was not a very good time to be working for the New York Times if you're somebody who believes that the media should be independent and should be challenging the dogmas and the so-called truths that are being disseminated in Washington. And I was picking up my newspaper every day and reading the same stories you were and feeling, if anything, even more frustrated as a person inside the institution. And we had this bizarre closed circle where somebody in the vice president's office would come up with some wild fantasy and then they would sell it to somebody at the New York Times. It would then appear on the front page. And then the vice president would be able to go on TV and say, "Hey, I'm not making this stuff up. I mean, it was on the New York Times front page." This got me more and more irritated. And I think maybe the moment that I really decided I gotta rethink my future was one night when I was living in Chicago. I had a neighbor who was the head of the Middle East Studies Center at the University of Chicago. One night before the Iraq War, I can still remember the restaurant. I can remember the scene vividly. We were sitting there drinking and talking about what a mess this was going to be. And basically, we'd each have a drink, and then each one would talk about another reason why this was going to go bad. He would start saying, "Well, let me tell you about the Shiites and the Sunnis, okay?" And I would say, "Oh, wait a minute, I'm going to talk about the Kurds." You know, and then we'd go on and on. "What about the Christians?" On and on. And by the time the end of the evening came, I thought not only was I... Maybe I was in a more conscious state by then. I was able to say, you know, I don't like this. I don't like that the only person I'm able to express my doubts to is my neighbor who I'm having drinks with. I want to be able to speak. I want to be able to beat my spoon on the high chair so other people can hear. And I realized I wouldn't be able to do that working at the New York Times because as a journalist, you have to be, you're not supposed to have these opinions of your own. I never liked the objectivity trope. I do think it's important for journalists to be fair, but fair is different from objective. Objective carries with it, to me, this idea that you have to be objective between the perpetrator and the victim, and I don't like that. So I've broken away from that a little bit and finally gotten to the point where I'm now trying to put together all those things I saw happening so fast all those years I was a newspaper reporter and trying to systematize them and try to understand what they mean. So what was it that I saw and how did all that lead to where we are today? You know, the facts of history
don't change, but our understanding of them changes. We rearrange them in new ways as time passes, and we begin to see things that weren't clear in an earlier period. This is particularly true in dealing with the Middle East because Americans were given such a partial picture of what was happening there. Many people are lamenting often about how ignorant Americans are, and I guess I'm one of them too. Nonetheless, I don't really think it's just our ignorance that's the problem. We're not the only ignorant people in the world. If people in, let's say, Paraguay are ignorant about Iran, that's a shame. That's their loss. But it doesn't really hurt anybody. The problem with us is we act on our ignorance. We launch wars on the basis of our ignorance. So our ignorance is more pernicious because it's tied to our compulsive activism. It's not possible for an American in the mainstream of our foreign policy establishment to look around the world and say, you know, there's a crisis somewhere in another country several thousand miles away, and we're just going to see how it unfolds, and we're going to wait and see what happens. We don't do that. Americans are not... We don't have the impulse to understand things. We have the impulse to do things. And that's not a bad impulse as long as you also have the other one. You want to do things after you understand things. Too often, I think, our impulse for activism dominates our very muted desire to understand things. We are weaned on this can-do mentality of American exceptionalism. And this can-do mentality is a wonderful thing. It's what made us develop the electric light bulb and go to the moon and do all the wonderful things this country has accomplished. But there are some limits to the can-do mentality that I don't think we always recognize. Can-do mentality tells you that if you work hard enough and you want something badly enough, you're going to get it. And that works if you're dealing with challenges that are posed by technology or by nature or by other people sometimes, but challenges that are posed by deep-seated cultures that were already thriving and long existing when the United States hadn't even come into being yet are not so easy to change just because you really want to change them. If we decide we really want to change the culture of Afghanistan, that's a lot harder than going to the moon, because it's about culture. And I think Afghanistan is actually an interesting starting point to talk about some of the situations that we're in the Middle East proper. Just as an example, so Afghanistan, as many of you know, has never had a strong central government. It's always been a group of clans and tribes and ethnicities, and the king never had authority over them. He only had a moral authority. He could convince people to go along, but he had to convince them. Well, we decided this is no good. Countries can't be like this. Countries need to be strongly centralized. And there has to be a central authority in the capital whose word is final that everyone in the country will obey. So essentially what we're saying is everything that has existed in Afghanistan for thousands of years is no good anymore. Now we Americans are coming and we're going to show you how you really should have a country. This is what we're doing now. We're fighting to give them a country that they've never had and don't want. It's not a long-term winning proposition. Now we're doing some of the same things in the Middle East. Now, you heard a little bit about Iran, and I want to talk a little about Iran as a starting place because I've learned so much, not just about global politics, but also about life, from spending a lot of time with Iranians. Iran is a fascinating country because its culture is so deep. It goes back thousands of years. That was the first empire. Although the first emperor, Cyrus, made it clear he would not rule over any people that did not want to be ruled by him. His human rights code is painted on the ceiling of the United States Capitol. So that's 3,000 years ago. That was a little bit before the United States got here. So you can understand that Iranians have a very deep sense of themselves and their identity and their culture and their history. They've learned a lot of things over all these centuries. One of the things that I've learned from Iranians is something that really contradicts what we learn as Americans. Americans believe every problem has a solution. If you work at it hard enough,
You're going to find the solution. If it's very complicated, you can just break it down into its component parts and have a lot of subcommittees working on everything, and you're going to get together, and finally you're going to solve the problem. Iranians would tell you, this is nonsense. There are many big problems in the world and many big problems in life that don't have any solution. You're just going to have to learn to live with them. This is not an American idea. We want everything in the world to look the way we want it to look. And if it doesn't look that way, we're going to go over there and we're going to fix it until things look the way we think they should look. Now, Iran is a great example of a country that has a national narrative very different from our narrative about what happened in that country. For the United States, policy, the relations between U.S. and Iran all goes back to what happened in 1979, the hostage crisis. It's all about that. That was the beginning and the end. That defines everything that happens between the United States and Iran. Iranians have a somewhat similar view. It all goes back to one episode, but it's a different episode. It's the overthrow of the Iranian government by the CIA in 1953. You know, when I first got to Iran, I asked myself a question that I often ask when I go to a new country, and that is, how did this country get to be like this? Why is this country rich and prosperous, or why is this country poor and miserable? Well, in Iran, that question is immediate. So you've got a country that has one of the most sophisticated cultures in world history. And the society is hugely advanced, highly educated, and the civil society, very rich and sophisticated. But yet, it's in this odd position where it's got this very unpopular regime, and the people are totally isolated from the rest of the world, and when you show your passport, you're from Iran, you're automatically a pariah. Why this huge disconnect? So what happened? How did this country, with all of its potential, get a government and a regime like this? Well, I started asking people when I was there, doing a little reading, and finally people started telling me, well, you know, we had a democracy at one time. But the Americans and the British came over here and destroyed it and created a dictatorship, and we've been living under tyranny ever since. I thought, well, that's quite a story. My first reaction was, as soon as I get out, I'm going to get myself a couple of books on the coup of 1953 and find out what really happened. Imagine my astonishment to realize there was no such book. This huge episode that did so much to change the world, not just Iran, the 1953 overthrow of the democratic government of Iran, had never been written about in a coherent way. So I realized in order to read that book, I was going to have to write it first. And that book has actually been very successful, and I think one of the reasons is something that I often hear from people who come up and talk to me about my books, and one of the first lines I always get is, wow, I never knew any of this happened. Or, gee, I went to history classes, I've read my books, how come they didn't teach me this? When you read a big, fat history of the 20th century in 1,000 pages, you'd be lucky if this episode even gets one line. And that shows you how distorted history can be. I sometimes ask myself why it is that the United States has such an enormous, unending obsession with World War II. Was World War II a huge event? Of course it was. And did it shape the world we live in? Of course. On the other hand, you could fill every building on this campus with the books and the videos and everything else that's produced about World War II, and it never stops. It's just, a week doesn't go by without more miniseries and movies. And I think one of the reasons is that World War II portrays us as we like to believe that we are. We fought evil dictators, and we left democracy. In many other cases, it was the other way around. That's why we don't study those cases. We like to forget those. I think we're all like this in our personal lives a little bit, too. We like to remember those episodes that show us the way we think we are. And things that we've done that don't reflect what we think is our real character tend to fade off in our memory to the point where we even don't even remember that they ever happened. Now, I talked about the vibrant civil society in Iran. It's truly remarkable to me how popular Americans are in Iran. Unless somebody can give me a counterexample, I'm going to keep saying this. I think the population of Iran is the most pro-American population in the whole world, which I think is probably something many newspaper readers would be surprised to hear. There's probably no country where the distance between what the regime thinks of America and what people think of America is so great. I was on a street corner in Shiraz when I was there last year, and just waiting for the light to change, I mentioned to the person next to me that I'm America, they call it. I'm from America. And within a few seconds, I was surrounded by about a dozen people kind of screaming and practically swooning. And one woman said to me, "We know they say terrible things about us over there, but we love America so much." You don't even get that in Canada. So whatever we do with Iran, and whatever policy we follow over these next months and years, and it's starting to, the alarms are starting to go off again, I think it's very important that we realize that the pro-American sentiment of the Iranian people is a huge strategic asset for us, and it will be going forward. Let's, whatever we do, not do anything to liquidate that asset, like bomb all those people who really want to love us. Now, there's one other country in the Muslim Middle East that, like Iran, has been working towards democracy for 100 years. So Iran had its constitutional revolution in 1906. This has not even happened yet in some Arab countries. And around the same time, Turkey started its move towards democracy. Now, Turkey and Iran are the two most democratic countries in the Muslim Middle East in terms of society. But in terms of government, only the democratic society of Turkey has managed to produce a democratic government. The Democratic Society of Iran has not. Why is this? Both have been working on this democratic project for a long time. So I think there's probably a series of long and involved arguments. In fact, it's a good PhD thesis topic for anyone out there who's looking for one. But I'm going to reduce that PhD thesis down to one word, which means that maybe it's not such a good thesis topic. And that word is oil. Iran found out, after deciding it wanted to become a constitutional monarchy, that it was sitting on an ocean of oil. Turkey doesn't have any oil. When you are in possession of something very valuable that powerful people want to steal, and you're weak, you're in trouble. And that's what happened. That's why the Iranian democracy was overthrown. Because it reflected the will of its own people. And the will of its own people was Iran should control Iranian oil. Those who did control it in those days, the government of Great Britain, did not like that idea. That was the beginning of the problem. And it was the British who decided they wanted to overthrow Dr. Mossadegh, the prime minister of Iran, and they brought the Americans in on the project. That was not only the end of Mossadegh's government, it was the end of democracy in Iran forever. At least up to now. I think we're going to work to the point where we one day will get back to 1953. But had we been patient and allowed Iran to develop on its own, we might have had a thriving democracy in the heart of the Muslim Middle East all these 50 years. And I can hardly wrap my mind around how different the Middle East might be had that been the problem. The reason that Turkey was able to develop differently is that Turkey didn't have anything anybody wanted to steal. You sometimes read about countries being blessed with resources. It's not always an appropriate phrase. Sometimes resources can be a curse, and Iranians know that as well as anyone. Now, Iranians have also learned another deep but very painful lesson from history. They come from a long historical tradition like the Chinese, which allows them to think that if you have a bad century, it's no big deal. You just have a good century next time. We don't think like that. Iranians do not expect things to happen right away all of a sudden. Things are going to happen, they're going to unfold on their own. History has its own dynamic. Nonetheless, Iran has also learned something from its history of revolution. I'm often asked, so when is the revolution coming to Iran?
We've been seeing it's going in a lot of countries nearby, so when are the Iranians going to have their revolution?
Answer, they already had their revolution. They had a revolution in 1979. The old order, servile to the West, that was kicked out. Now, so Iranians are not looking for their next revolution. In fact, they're doing the opposite. They understand what revolution can bring. They have had a very painful experience.
During the period when the rebellion against the Shah was gathering force,
why were all these different factions that hated each other able to get together to fight the Shah? So you had the liberals who liked Mossadegh and wanted secular democracy. You had communists. Of course, you had the mullahs, the religious class. They didn't get along, and there were various other factions, but they all agreed on one obvious fact, which was, we don't know what's coming next, but whatever it is, it's going to be better than what we have. Well, what happened? They got something worse. They have learned a lesson, which we, I think, in America still haven't learned. It's the lesson that of what a folly it is to believe there's a few bad people. If we can just get rid of those really bad people, democracy is going to flower, we're all going to live happily. That's a utopian idea. And the Iranians, I would call a post-utopian nation. They don't believe that anymore. They are going to wait for history to unfold at its own pace. I had a guy tell me in front of Cyrus's tomb, actually, when I was there last time, and I asked him about the Green Movement, this explosion that followed the elections of 2 years ago. And he said, well, we tried something. It didn't work. Now, things are not so awful here that we want to go throw ourselves against the bayonets of the Revolutionary Guard. So what we want to do is live our lives. And we're going to get the result we want. We're just not going to get it on the timetable that we originally thought. I want to bring that guy over to America, try to advise some of our people in Washington. We are in a position now, as we look around the Middle East, that we ourselves are a victim of this narrative of the few bad people. We have to believe that regimes and nations that are hostile to us have been hijacked by a small group, because the alternative is to believe that that kind of sentiment actually reflects popular will, and this doesn't fit in our mentality. We believe that either people have been misled if they don't like us, or they have to say this because it was Saddam and his sons. They made them say that. If we could just get rid of them, they'll like us. And you know, I see this again. It's a version of something we practice in our personal lives and the way we look at the world. Like, well, I, for example, am a really, really nice guy. If you don't like me, there's only two possible reasons. One is you don't know me. You don't realize what a wonderful person I am. And the other is you're a jerk, so naturally you wouldn't like a nice guy like me. It can't be possible that you know me, who I am, you're very well informed, and you just don't, you really don't like me. You're liking me for the reasons of who I am and what I do. This is not possible. Because on that basis, there'd be no reason to dislike me. This is the fantasy with which the United States ventures out into the world. And it's what leads us to believe that if you can just decapitate these ruling cliques, the next thing you know, everybody's going to be pro-American. The last place we've seen this is Libya. So if we started early, let me now march backward from the present day. I actually have a piece of advice for those that want to celebrate the liberation of Libya, and that is, do it quickly. There's time to rejoice now, but that's not going to last very long, because Libya is going to reassert itself. Libya also has never had a united government, except under Gaddafi. Other than that, it's 140 tribes, many of whom have all sorts of problems and had a different way of relating to themselves under traditional society, but that way has now been destroyed by impositions from above. They don't have these ways of maintaining peace among themselves anymore. So I think Libya is a place that reflects dramatically this fantasy that you have a few bad actors, and if you just go over there and get rid of them, things will flower in such a positive way. I don't see anything, frankly, in Libyan or Middle Eastern history that leads me to believe this can happen. I fervently hope for it, but I'm not going to bet any part of my family farm on that one. Now, let's move over next door to Egypt. Libya is not an important country in the scheme of things, even in the Middle East or in the Arab or Muslim world, but Egypt is. Egypt is all of those things. Now, in Egypt, we are seeing unfolding something that I think we're going to see in other liberated countries where pro-Western dictators have been overthrown. And that is very tentative and unsteady steps toward democracy. Let me tell you what I think I've learned from watching the case of Turkey and Iran as they've progressed toward democracy. I believe that any country can embrace Western-style parliamentary democracy, but there are two conditions. First of all, you have to want it. It can't be something that somebody told you you need to have. It has to be a genuine desire that emerges from populations, which is what happened in Turkey and Iran. And the other thing is, it takes a long time. I mean, we can all remember things in our own lifetimes that were so profoundly undemocratic in this country. Then we became more democratic. Now I think we're probably back on the swing the other way. But this idea that we have the model of perfect democracy and we're waiting for everyone to get to be like us is another part of our fantasy. Here's one of the things that I think is already happening in Egypt. You're going to start seeing it in Tunisia and certainly in Libya if they ever even have a government to go anywhere in Libya. And that is, if these countries move towards democracy, if they move towards some form of regime that genuinely reflects the will of their people, it is going to mean a closing of the space for democracy and human rights for many people. It's a contradiction here. More democracy in some of these countries is going to lead to less rights. I just give you one example. There is now a campaign going on in Egypt led by the Islamic Brotherhood, but they don't want to get out in front of it, and their Women's Federation is leading this. They want to repeal what are called Susan Mubarak's laws. These are a package of laws that were essentially decreed by the president, like all laws were there, at the wishes of his wife. One says, women should be allowed to compete for custody of their children after a divorce. The other says, women should be allowed to travel abroad without the permission of their husbands. There is now a major campaign going on in Egypt to repeal these laws. They are seen as impositions by the Western elite. There's momentum behind these campaigns. And I'm not an expert on Egyptian public opinion, but I believe they will drive to repeal Susan Mubarak's laws will have a broad popular support because this conception that they were imposed by a Western-oriented elite and actually reflect a Western sensibility is true. Now, I'd like to see that sensibility embraced by more people, but the fact is democracy in the Middle East is not conducive to that. It's also not conducive to minority rights. I believe that although we do have the evolution and the emergence of a group of democratically oriented people and a democratically oriented generation in many countries in the Muslim Middle East, their experience with democracy is non-existent yet. They're just starting. And their understanding of it is perhaps therefore somewhat partial. They've grasped the fundamental essence of democracy, which is that the majority should rule. But they haven't fully grasped the other piece, which is that while ruling, the majority must also guard the rights of the minorities. This part has not really penetrated into the democratic ideologies, as they are called, of people in many Arab countries. And I think the real reason is they're just starting with this. I mean, Turkey was a quasi-democracy. Turkey's, so they started getting toward, moving towards democracy in 1923. Until about 10 years ago, they had still progressed only maybe two-thirds of the way. That was a 70-year project. Iran has been working for that long. They have a democratic mentality, but their government hasn't gotten there yet. This is a long process. And I think we're sometimes being misled by the promises that these societies are going to change overnight, and they're going to change in ways that will be positive for us. Actually, I think the United States is going to remain engaged in the Middle East, if only to protect Israel and assure our sources of oil. But we're never going to be as powerful as we were in the second half of the 20th century. That was the high point of our influence. Now, I see us right now being, I see the Middle East now being in a position quite similar to what it was in at the end of World War II. At that time, one big power had dominated the Middle East for at least half a century. That was Britain. Britain was finished. Not necessarily voluntarily, but Britain was on the way out. So there was a power vacuum. Into that power vacuum stepped the United States. Now, that power vacuum is re-emerging because the United States is leaving the region. And there are a number of reasons for this. The invasion of Iraq upset regional balances and in the end caused a great loss of strategic power for the United States. America's support for the West Bank settlement project and for the occupation of Gaza has further isolated us from public opinion in that part of the world. Nonetheless, we persist in this idea that once liberated, everyone in the Middle East, and the Muslim countries particularly, will embrace us and love us. They don't have any real reason to do this. I must say, I'm still impressed when I travel around the Middle East at the fact that despite all of our sins, there's still a tremendous reservoir of goodwill towards the United States. There's admiration for what we have accomplished. I think there's a great puzzlement about some of our policies, and people don't understand why we're following those, and it's quite a trick to try to explain that. Nonetheless, these upheavals that are now shaping the Middle East are not likely to bring us to regimes that were the ideals we sought when we promoted these movements. We are entering into a different era now. Now, I said that there's this power vacuum. So who is moving to fill it? Well, the two most aggressive contenders have been Iran and Saudi Arabia. Our invasion of Iraq was the best gift that anybody ever gave the Republic of Iran. We were Iran's biggest enemy. Iran, at that time, was under the rule of Iran's second biggest enemy, Saddam. By decapitating that regime, which is, of course, rules a majority Shiite country, we handed that whole country over to Iran on a platter. So this was a huge geopolitical shot in the arm for Iran. And it's another reason why some deal between the United States and Iran could bear positive fruit, because Iran has the ability to keep things quiet in Iraq. And our nightmare is that when we leave, it's going to explode like it was in 2004, 2005. Iran can prevent that from happening, but only if they have a motivation to do so, and we're not giving them one. So Iran has definitely stepped into this battle. Every time you read something about Iran in the newspapers now, keep this in the back of your mind. Iran is contending with Saudi Arabia for hegemony over the Middle East, and the United States is very clearly on one side. We are very negative on Iran. Blocking Iran is a top priority of United States global diplomacy. And we also have always been friendly with Saudi Arabia for very obvious reasons, not just we buy their oil, but they buy billions and billions of our weaponry. Now we have even another reason to support Saudi Arabia, which is that Saudi Arabia has stepped up to lead the anti-Iran coalition. We've just within the last weeks announced a $50 million arms sale to Bahrain, I noticed, this tiny little island which is now under occupation by Saudi Arabia. We don't mind that occupation. We are also involved in placing anti-missile batteries and other military installations throughout the Persian Gulf, all in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. We are arming them. That is part of our confrontation with Iran. When you read about Iranian nuclear scientists being blown up in Tehran, when you read about the plot of the Iran to kill the Saudi Arabian ambassador, always keep this in the back of your mind, that there is a major confrontation going on in the world. It's like the new great game between Iran and Saudi Arabia for hegemony in the Middle East. And the United States is very eager to have all of us on the team, on the anti-Iran, pro-Saudi team. So just read the news with that lens. Now, Saudi Arabia has been extremely active over the more than, I'd say, for at least 20 years in a huge project that has to do with the fundamental basis of the Saudi state. Saudi Arabia is actually, I can't literally translate their national motto, but if it were to be translated into English in an honest way, I think it would be hypocrisy. That's the one word, that's the fundamental principle of life in Saudi Arabia. There are two fundamental pillars of support in that regime are the United States and the clergy of Wahhabi Islam, which hates the United States and everything that it stands for. So it was inevitable that this was not going to survive forever, and actually September 11th was the 100% result, that I think all but two or three of the hijackers came from Saudi Arabia, and that wasn't an accident, and Osama bin Laden also growing up in this environment. Now, in order to make sure that the Salafi clergy, which is the most extreme Islamic group in the whole world, does not turn to the Saudi princes and saying, "We don't like you taking baths in Johnny Walker and spending billions of dollars in the casinos in Marseille. That's not Islamic." We don't want them to say that. So what we do is we pay them billions of dollars to promote the most reactionary, hate-filled forms of Islam, but not here. Please promote them anywhere else in the world, and here's billions and billions of dollars for you to do this. I have seen the Saudi mosques going up from Lebanon all the way to Uzbekistan. And they send the religious teachers there to inculcate in people a form of Islam that has never existed in most of these countries. The kind of Islam you're seeing in Pakistan and Afghanistan now is not from there. Nobody ever had this concept of Islam before. Saudi Arabia has been spreading this for at least 20 years now. They're doing it with our money. So essentially, we are funding our own assassins through our support of Saudi Arabia. Nonetheless, this is our paradigm. You know, you heard at the introduction, Urban was saying we want to think outside the box. When I correct papers, I circle cliches and I put an X through them. So I won't use that one, think outside the box, but I'll think of some. We've got to think creatively. We've got to think in ways that are different from the ways we were thinking in the last century. I believe the United States can maintain its position in the world, but only if we change. The history shows that great powers rise and fall. That's an immutable law of history. And history also shows that the countries and empires and nations that last a long time are the ones that can adapt as the world changes. But the United States has never had to do this before. This is the first time we've really had to adapt to a changed world. We have no experience doing it. We're not good at it. And whether we will be able to do that, I think, is still a very open question. Now, I talked about this duel between Saudi Arabia and Iran for hegemony over the Middle East. But I think there's a curious new aspect to this duel. There have always been conflicts between would-be hegemons. But something big has changed since the last time this happened in the Middle East, and that is people want a say now. It used to be if you could just get the dictator on your side, then Egypt is now pro-American. Okay, Egypt, the dictator changes mind. Okay, Egypt's now pro-Soviet. That's the way you got countries. You dickered with the leaders, and if the leadership saw a package in one country that was more favorable, that's who they bring their whole country to. It's not that easy anymore. Autocrats cannot deliver whole nations to hegemons the way they used to. Smaller nations, I think in many cases, realize it's nice to have a big brother, but they want to have a say in who that big brother is now. And when many people in Egypt and in Syria and in Tunisia and other parts of the Muslim Middle East look at the two powers that are dueling for hegemony, Iran and Saudi Arabia, many of them are thinking, I don't like either one of them. I don't want to live under the deadening social restrictions of life in Iran or the same restrictions that are in Saudi Arabia. These are countries that are ruled by misogynistic gerontocracies that have their roots back in the last century. You've got an extremely young, vibrant, eager, democratic Middle East. And you've got these old men regimes with these 7th century ideas in Tehran and Riyadh. So the people of the Middle East are not happy with this dichotomy. So who might be other candidates for regional leadership? Well, you look over history, Iraq would certainly be one, and certainly that was Saddam's great ambition, be the next Saladin, the next great figure in the Middle East. And Egypt has had that position in the past, always the leading country in the Arab world. So those would be logical candidates, but right now they don't qualify because both of those countries are caught up in their own domestic problems. So this leads us to another country whose role has probably changed more dramatically in the last 10 years than any country in that region, maybe even than any country in the world, and that is Turkey. It wasn't that long ago. I would say it's the beginning of the last decade when Turkey played essentially no role in the world. It had no foreign policy, just whatever NATO told it to do. It was on the way off on the edge of everything. It wasn't really in Europe, and it wasn't in the Middle East, and it wasn't in the Baltics or the North Africa. So it was kind of isolated and inward-looking. Now, everything has changed for Turkey. Turkey is a huge player throughout the Middle East and beyond. Turkey's just opened 14 new embassies in Africa. Turkey has tremendous global ambitions. The 21st century is going to see the rise of middle powers, let's say, and Turkey is definitely going to be one of those. So let me conclude by talking a little bit about Turkey. Turkey was ripped violently up from its roots in the Middle Eastern sands by Kemal Atatürk in the 1920s and totally changed its direction to face toward the west, towards Europe. They abolished Sharia law and brought the civil codes from Switzerland. All the religious institutions were placed under the supervision of the government. All mullahs became government employees with advice on what they're supposed to say in every sermon. Women's education was promoted. The alphabet was changed from Arabic script to the Western script. A huge earthquake of changes took place under Atatürk. That put Turkey on the road to democracy, but even when he died, Turkey had not become a democracy. During the 1970s and 80s and 90s, Turkey functioned as a quasi-democracy, always with the military in the background. So the parliament was allowed to do what it wanted, and the prime minister could do what he wanted, but with a veto power. And if the army saw something they didn't like, they'd say, no, these are areas that we are interested in, and we're not going to let you do that. They always saw themselves as the guardians of the secular state. Well, now, just about 10 years ago, we had a breakthrough election, and a political party fundamentally reflecting the will of the majority emerged to dominate Turkey, and it's the party that's still in power now. This party has effectively managed to push the army completely out of power. So now, finally, you have a regime in Turkey that does emanate from the will of the majority. It's still suffering from a few of these pains that I mentioned earlier about not fully realizing that minorities also have to be protected in democracies. So from our position as Americans, we can certainly criticize the shortcomings of Turkish democracy. Nonetheless, the political party that now leads Turkey and that has provided this tremendous transformation is a very interesting one if you're sitting in another part of the Muslim Middle East. Now, people have often asked whether the Arab countries can follow the Turkish model. I mean, this would be the ideal dream scenario, that after some period, Egypt or Libya emerges like Turkey. That would be our fantasy. This is not realistic. The history of Turkey is so different from those countries that they're on their own path. So it's not realistic to hope that the Turkish model would be followed. However, the evolution of Islamic politics in Turkey does hold what I think is a very positive lesson for the rest of the Middle East. Turkey had a traditionally militant, fundamentalist-oriented Islamic party, actually fomented by the military, if you can believe this. The Great Guardians of Secularism in the 1980s decided that the Turkish youth was getting too leftist, too interested in Marxism. How to fight this? We need to give the young people something to believe in. So they literally called the head of the Islamic movement in Turkey, who they'd thrown out of the country and was living in Switzerland, and told him, come back here and revive your movement. And we're going to start opening religious schools, too, because we want kids to be interested in religion so they won't be Marxists. Well, thanks a lot. It didn't work. They produced this tendency inside Turkish society, which, again, was stirred up from coals that had been long since dying. So this political party rose to the point where, through a bizarre quirk of the Turkish electoral system, its leader emerged with 21% of the vote as prime minister of Turkey in the mid-1990s. Yeah, he decided Turkey's going to break away from Europe, we're going to have an Islamic currency, we're going to quit NATO. He had all these wild, crazy ideas. He only lasted about a year. Everybody was in panic about what he was doing. After that, this Islamic political party had a period of reflection. If that didn't work, people didn't like it. What happened? What are we going to do? Well, a group of reformers inside that party decided what we need to do is reorient this party, modernize it, make it the party of European values, but with its roots in Islam. So they tried a coup to seize control of the party. They failed, and so they quit the party. They went out, and they started their own party. And that attracted many of the people from the old party, but also many people who would never have voted for that old party. What you had in Turkey, and what we have in Turkey now as a governing party, is a phenomenon unique in the Muslim world. The party with its roots in Islamic politics is the most pro-democracy, pro-Europe, pro-capitalist party in the whole country. This has been a huge winning combination. This party has produced a booming economy and a country that is now able to project its influence, not by military, but by soft power throughout the Muslim world and beyond. Because people sitting on the streets in Tunisia and Egypt and Syria are thinking to themselves, I don't want to live like they live in Iran. I don't want to live like they do in Saudi Arabia. But I want to live like the Turks do. Now, as I said, using Turkey as a model for Egypt or for Libya is not realistic. But each of these countries has a party with its roots in Islam. Those parties are now, for the first time, able to participate actively in politics. And they're trying to think, so what should be our appeal? What kind of a party should we be? Here is where an example from Turkey, I think, is already very strong. The model of having a party that's Islamic, but also pro-democracy and pro-Western and pro-European, is something that Turkey has given to these countries. And I do think that is going to be a popular model. It remains to be seen to what extent regimes will accept the participation of those groups in politics. But I'd say this. It's not realistic to expect that in a country where the large majority of the people are Muslim, you are going to get a government that is fully secular, unless it's undemocratic. If it's democratic, there's going to be a religious influence. That's not necessarily bad. The question is, what kind of an Islamic influence is it going to be? What kind of religious influence? And that's why I see something very positive in the Turkish model. So Turkey managed to survive all this time to be able to provide this model for the rest of the Islamic world because it doesn't have anything that countries want to steal. Now it has something that it wants to give other countries, and I hope other countries will be willing to accept it. I think I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. Thank you. So I'm eager to take some questions. I can tell you this. Every time I go to Washington, which is as rarely as possible, I am struck by how narrow is the spectrum of acceptable options. You must believe something in this very narrow spectrum, otherwise you get laughed out of the room. That's maybe one reason why I never get invited to those lunches anymore. I did, however, notice in reading up on my history that back in the 1940s in Lancaster County, there was a Congressman Kinzer. So I think maybe here's the place from which I could launch myself. Go ahead.
How is the United States going to get its foreign policy out from under the domination of Israel, or by Israel?
So the question is, how will the United States pull its foreign policy out from under the dominance of Israel? I got to see if anything's ticking under here first. Well, you've put your finger on a serious problem. I first of all, you're absolutely right that the AIPAC lobby and advocates for current Israeli policies have tremendous influence in Washington. I would say before we start lamenting their influence and what they do, that we should realize they're only doing what's legal. So we let them do this. We make the rules as Americans. So they are only doing what the big pharma does, or what agribusiness does, or what the gas lobby and the financial services lobby do. We have essentially turned over our government to these organizations because the people that pay for the elections of the people in our government are working for those organizations. This is one of the things I meant when I talked about the level of democracy declining in the United States. But I think before we get to the substance, it's important to realize the Israeli lobby is not running rampant over American law. They're only doing what they're allowed to do. So if we want to know where the problem is, we could look in the mirror first. And I saw on TV when I was waiting at the airport an ad or an interview with one of those NASCAR drivers. And I was fascinated by it as I looked at it because he's wearing the same outfit. All those NASCAR drivers, so they wear a leather jacket and it has all these patches. So you know who sponsors them. It says Pennzoil, Exxon, Toyota. I'm thinking, that's what the congressmen should do. They should be forced to wear a badge. It's going to say Pfizer, Cargill, General Dynamics. It would make it easier. Just to make it clear where they're coming from, it helps you put everything in perspective. And I think there could be some like fully owned AIPAC jacket, make their own jackets. It's really remarkable that the United States has not only come under the thrall of Israel, but under the thrall of a particular strain of Israeli politics, which happens to be dominant now. I'm always amazed when I'm in Israel that the ability of people to debate about Israel is much bigger in Israel than it is here. You'll see members of the Knesset say things that no member of Congress would dare to say. And newspaper articles denouncing the Israeli government and its policies, which would be things that would get you fired in America very quietly, always appearing on the op-ed page in Haaretz, which never ceases to amaze me. What I fear about Israel truly is that Israel seems to have come to the conclusion that it can guarantee its survival indefinitely through weaponry alone. The fact that it's surrounded by hundreds of millions of people that hate it won't matter as long as they have enough guns and enough rockets and supported by the United States. I see this as very dangerous to Israel's long-term security. And if you're really worried about what could happen to Israel in 100 years, to me, this is the real concern. In the modern age, I mean, even Gandhi figured this out with the British 50 years ago. There's other ways to defeat a militarily powerful country by appealing to people's conscience. And I think maybe that's beginning. I still haven't really addressed your question. How do we begin to change this? The only thing I can think of is it has to start from below. You have to start by educating Congressman Kinzer or whoever it is from here. I also think that we've developed this mantra in the United States where, particularly at election time, your first job is to figure out how pro-Israel your opponent is and then be more pro-Israel than that guy, who will then immediately become more pro-Israel than you. We were talking about this at lunch. I think there is one way where that the United States would be able to break away from, for example, from the hostility to Iran, which is largely driven by Israel. And that would be something that I think it's not possible at this moment, given certain geopolitical quirks, but I could see it happening. If people in Iran, in the geostrategic thinking department, start to look around the region and figure out what kind of a strategic breakthrough could we make that would dramatically improve our position, it would be to make a deal with Israel. Actually, Iran and Israel have been partners in the past. They have a lot in common. They have this great mutual respect between Persian and Jewish culture. And also when it comes to Arabs, they both have, how am I going to put this gently? Their admiration is limited, let's say. They have even collaborated on weapons, on oil in the past. The minute that Israel and Iran make a deal, Washington is going to love Iran too. That's all that's doing it. Sometimes I'm thinking, since that tail is wagging this dog, what can move that tail? I think, and Israel, I think, has strategic thinkers who do something that we don't do very often, which is think about, like, what's in our interests? I'm a great believer in interests. Let's forget about emotion. Now, emotion is the number one enemy of sound foreign policy making. You should think about what's in your interest and what deals can you make that are in your interest. And when the United States looks around that part of the world and we think about what are our biggest challenges, Iraq, Afghanistan, terrorism, nuclear proliferation, you cannot resolve any of those without the participation of Iran. That is in our interest. But we can't deal with Iran because we're not dealing on the basis of interests. We're dealing on the basis of emotion. And that will continue, I think, until we remove that force that is fanning that emotion every day. Yes, ma'am.
If Turkey is such a great Islamic influence for the rest of the Islamic world, couldn't Turkey become a big target for Al-Qaeda?
Interesting question. If Turkey becomes more of a model for the Islamic world, wouldn't radicals like Al-Qaeda see Turkey as a place they don't want to attack? I do think that this is a reasonable assumption, and I think there's some indication that at least on a small scale, some are already starting to think this way. It's precisely because Turkey is such a successful society that it seems much more appealing than Saudi Arabia and Iran. I had an interview with the president of Turkey once when he told me, the best thing that we do to spread our influence is we just sit here and we open the borders. Turkey has open visas if you're Syrian, if you're Iranian, for example. I think it might be certainly the only country in the Middle East where an Iranian can go without a visa. And he says, we like that. Just come here and walk around. That's going to do a huge amount to change the Middle East. We're going to bring everyone in the Middle East. Just come here and just sit and look. And therefore, those who do not want this model to be followed in other parts of the world have an interest in making it seem like Turkey's actually not that successful. Maybe Turkey's plagued by sectarian violence. I think this is one thing lying behind the sudden upsurge in violence between the Kurdish rebels and the Turkish army. They've had some terrible episodes in recent weeks and months. I think, without tying it too directly to the question that preceded this, there is an effort in Washington to demonize Turkey now, to add Turkey to the list of bad countries like Iran is. Now, this one doesn't have so much traction because a lot of people have been to Turkey. Turkey is a member of NATO. Turkey is more closely tied to the United States. Nonetheless, one way that Turkey can be made to look bad is if they seem to be brutalizing the Kurds. In the Kurdish rebellion, they've never managed to get this going. So if you wanted to make Turkey seem like it actually was a divided society with a lot of social troubles, one good thing you would do is encourage people to rebel, encourage the Kurdish movement to get more active. So I think there are anti-Turkey forces that are in part behind that. So I think you've put your finger on something that I think the Turks need to worry about, and I think they already are. Thank you. Yes? So the question was about Morocco and the situation there. I actually don't have a particular preference among forms of government. Dictatorships have gotten a real bad name. And I can see, there have been some people, there have been some dictators that weren't so nice. But forms of government are not intrinsically good or bad. They have no form in themselves. What they do is they get us to other places. They can bring us benefits that actually are tangible. We've chosen our form of government because it brings us things that are valuable to us, like security and prosperity. But those are the valuable things. It's not that the democracy is just what happens to be the path that we take that gets us those things. If another path gets you the things that you need, then that's fine with me too. In America, we have a great fixation on how people got to power. I want to be sure you got to power in the same way people get to power in this country. If you didn't, you're not legitimate. But in most of the world, this is not an issue. In most of the world, more people are more interested in, what did you do when you were in power? Were you a good leader? Okay, then we don't care how you came to power. If you got elected and you're a terrible leader, we don't want you. So, this is a roundabout way of saying, monarchy is not necessarily inferior to democracy. Monarchy also covers a whole range of kinds of systems, from absolutist to purely constitutional. I believe that each country develops its own path according to cultural situations and political history and religion and various other factors, the mix of which is different from country to country. I actually think the Moroccan monarchy has been fairly successful in navigating this. I haven't been there recently or focused on this too intently. But actually, Morocco is one place, like Algeria, where I sometimes am asked, so when is it going to happen there? I mean, if it's happening all around, aren't they going to get the bug? Sometimes I think maybe it has the opposite effect. You begin to think, wow, look what happened in Libya, Tunisia, we don't know where it's going. Maybe it's better, you don't want to have the Iran situation. So I'm thinking that that might be a country where the message was received enough so that it can be responded to within institutional channels. I've gotten to be such a reactionary in my old age. When I was 20, I wanted to smash the nuclear family as the basis of capitalism. Now I love institutions. I realize that institutions are what hold society together. And what we call bourgeois values, those are great values. They're great for communities. So wiping everything out, the tabula rasa of revolution, is more appealing the further you are away from it. We've sort of fetishized it a little bit because of our revolution, but our revolution actually was not a revolution at all if you look up what revolution means in a dictionary. We didn't replace the social order like Lenin did or the mullahs did in Iran. We became independent, but we call it a revolution. And then because of that, I think we feel like any revolution anywhere in the world is something we should support. And we've actually gone out and fomented our share of them. Maybe after we see the results of some of them, we might be a little happier with some leaders who are able to adjust to changing circumstances without requiring complete replacement. Yes?
You had mentioned during your talk that you thought that the Iraqi situation has essentially handed that over to
yes.
Iran. I think, on the other hand, it's very unlikely that Iraq is going to become a puppet government to Iran. They have their own cultural differences with Iran that goes back to the Persian Empire and the Babylonian Empire and all of that. So historically, they have been an independent-minded people, and only this last regime was one of actual persecution an Iraq war anymore, but it's not going to be a puppet government.
So that was a comment about Iran and Iraq. The questioner mentioned that I had said we had handed Iraq over to Iran, but wasn't it true that Iraq is not going to become completely submerged under the Iranian identity, that it has identity of its own? I think you're absolutely correct. As a matter of fact, Iran has a very high hand to play in Iraq, but it's not as high as they think it is. They're overplaying it, and I think that's stirring up some resentment. Nonetheless, the fact is, Iran is the heartland of Shia Islam, and Iraq is a majority Shia country. Those Shias had been heavily brutalized under the Saddam regime, and many of the leaders of the Shia community in Iraq went to live in Iran. They've been living in Iran 20 years. Iran is now using Shia communities all throughout the Middle East as its cat's paws. That's what was behind the uprising in Bahrain. They looked around and they saw Bahrain has a majority Shiite community. Shiites in many countries tend to be the more oppressed or marginalized or poorer groups, so let's have them rebel. That's what happened in Bahrain. Then Saudi Arabia came in and crushed the rebellion. So the Iranians want to use their position in Shiism as a kind of a lance point, to as a way to a lever for them to get into other societies. But sectarian divisions in Iraq are also a relatively new innovation. You know, I talked to one reporter who was in Iraq at an early stage of the American occupation, and he told me this story. I hope it isn't true. He said that he accompanied an American major who was in charge of some piece of some province. He had called together all of the tribal leaders in one tent. He wanted to get to know them, and he wanted to make a speech for them. And when he arrived, the first thing he said was, just to make things easier for me and for everybody else, could I ask the Sunni leaders to sit on this side and the Shia leaders to sit on the other side? And this guy said to me, some of them were looking at each other and saying, are you Sunni? So now we've got Americans coming here telling us, okay, we understand the fundamental division in your country. And we're saying, duh, did we have a fundamental division? Well, we read that on some handout sheet. So I believe there is a desire in Iraq to move away from this sectarian division that outsiders have fomented and tried to play on, including the United States. And now they see Iran as trying to foment this ethnic or confessional division. And I think they don't like it. So I think you're absolutely right. Iraq is not going to become a colony of Iran. Nonetheless, you have a democratic government, and therefore the leadership is going to be Shia. And the Shia leadership in Iraq is always going to be responsive to Iran, regardless of politics. The degree to which it's responsive will change, according to politics. But there is no outside power in the world, including the United States, that could do more to stabilize Iraq than Iran. Iran has a lot of buttons to push in Iraq, and actually almost as much authority in Afghanistan. Iran has done huge favors for the United States in Afghanistan. It was Iran that connected us with the Northern Alliance when we were looking to rent an army to overthrow the Taliban. And Iranians were eager to build on this when suddenly they got the Axis of Evil speech. Iran has the ability to help pacify Afghanistan and to do a great deal to pacify Iraq, but you're right. I think before they would be willing to turn on the Iranians and say, you're the outside power that's intervening here too much, they have to lose their focus on another outside power that's been intervening too much. Yes?
I think you may be exaggerating too much the role of Israel in defining U.S. policy toward Iran. We haven't mentioned China at all. We haven't mentioned the gas and oil resources of Central Asia. We haven't talked much about Afghanistan and the bogus discussion about al-Qaeda as if that's why we're there. U.S. has a lot of reasons for being in that part of the world that are not at the direction of Israel, I would say.
So the question was, is Israel really the fundamental reason for our policy toward Iran, our hostility toward Iran? You know, I think you're absolutely right that the United States has a panoply of interests in the Middle East and has for many decades. And I think you're right that, of course, Israel and Saudi Arabia have been our main partners in the Middle East for 50 years. I think you're right that Israel does not shape American policy toward the Middle East, but I do think that in the particular case of Iran, Israel has developed, or a certain group of people in Israel have developed a fixation on Iran, that Iran is the number one threat to peace in the world. And they've managed to, this they have managed to sell in Washington. Actually, I'm one of the few people in America, outside of defense contractors, who've fully benefited from this. And I'm on my, this is the second time this has happened to me, because many years ago, when I was just starting out in journalism, I got very interested in a country that nobody in the world was interested in, almost literally, and that was Nicaragua. One day, it turned out suddenly that the New York Times decided things had gotten so far in Nicaragua they wanted to have a bureau there. They wanted to hire a correspondent. And they were looking for somebody who had two qualifications, worked for a big paper already and had been to Nicaragua. I later found out they found there's only two people in America that fit that bill, and the other one said no. That's how I first got hired by the New York Times. And if it hadn't been for the fact that Ronald Reagan decided that that miserable mud pile of Nicaragua was the greatest threat to freedom in the world, nobody would have cared if somebody knew about Nicaragua. Now the same thing has happened to me with Iran. I get interested in Iran, and the next thing you know, we're starting to hear the whole world is all dependent on what happens with Iran. And where did we get this from? I think we got it from Israel. I think there are other reasons for us to be active in other parts of that region, but it's not automatic that if we were looking out for our interests in the Middle East, we would be this fixated on Iran. I think the fact that we have added that one on with such intensity is at least in part related to the fact that Israel sees it with this intensity. But let me just add one interesting anecdote, if I can. I was last in Israel, it was a couple of years ago now, and I participated in a conference about Iran at Tel Aviv University. And if you want to have a lot of fun at an airport, walk up to the immigration inspector in Israel and say, "I'm here to discuss Iran." That'll get you plenty of attention. Fortunately, the people sponsoring the conference had given me a letter for this exact eventuality, saying, yes, there is a conference, yes, he is invited, and call this number, and we'll tell you the details. So I was able to get into the country. We had our conference, and then at the end of the day, when the conference was all over, they took the panelists off to a dinner, which I sort of expected, in some nice hotel overlooking the Mediterranean on the top floor. We had our nice dinner, and then there was a speaker. I'm not going to mention his name because the first thing they said when he went into the room was, he said, "There's no reporters here, right?" And I had to push my hand down. I'm not a reporter anymore. So he's a deputy prime minister in charge of intelligence affairs, one of the leading figures in the Israeli government. And he's going to give an off-the-record tour d'horizon. So how does Israel see the world? Which was very, very interesting. What I really liked, I spent about half the time talking about Iran. And he said something that I thought was fascinating. He said, "Now, you're all reading in your newspapers around the world that Israel is afraid of Iran getting a nuclear weapon, and because they're afraid that once Iran gets a nuclear weapon, immediately they're going to bomb Israel." This is half true. We are very worried about Iran getting a nuclear weapon, but not for that reason. Actually, nobody in our security establishment believes that Iran would ever send a nuclear bomb into Israel. They know that it would mean the complete liquidation of Iran within 5 minutes. And even they're not that crazy. We don't want Iran to have a nuclear weapon for several other reasons. One is it could set off an arms race in the region. Pretty soon Egypt has one, Saudi Arabia. Then we're really in trouble. And another reason is once you have a nuclear weapon, you don't have to use it. You're able to push people around a lot more. You can intimidate people. And, of course, I guess the Israelis have some knowledge about this. So the guy said to us, we don't contradict What we read in foreign newspapers when it says the Israelis are afraid, Israel will bomb them as soon as they get a nuclear weapon. Because it makes perfect sense. It's logical. It's not true, but it seems logical. So we don't contradict it. It's nice to have people believe that. Because if we started to say, well, you know, it has to do with the way they can influence other countries in the future, that doesn't grab people enough. And then he said, it's just like what you guys did with the Iraq War. You had 20 different reasons, but you figured you're only going to mention one. Weapons of mass destruction. It doesn't, whether it's true or not, is almost a side issue. You want something that people can grab onto that seems real and terrifying. And he said, so that's why we let this go in the outside press, that we're terrified that the first nuclear bomb Iran manufactures is going to land in Tel Aviv. But actually, we don't believe any of this. Don't repeat that. Yes, sir. Could I comment on Turkish relations with Israel? A very interesting subject. Turkey, like Iran, has a long history of good relations with Israel. With the Turks and the Jews, there's a long history, just like with the Persians and the Jews. I mean, it was Cyrus who freed the Jews from their Babylonian captivity, according to my Bible, which, I mean, that's the Bible for me. And the Turks and Jews had a very good relationship. There was a time during the Ottoman Empire when more than half the Jews in the world were living under Ottoman rule, and that was because of many emigrations. We even have letters from, like, the chief rabbi of Adrianople, now Edirne, to the Jews of Poland. Come live here. There's no Cossacks. Nobody will bother you. You can live under your own olive tree. Actually, another very interesting moment in the history of this relationship came in the 1930s. So Atatürk was in power, and one of his great frustrations, I think he died of his frustrations. We say that he died from too much drink. I think he died from an overdose of turkey. He was totally frustrated with the pace of change, even though it was tremendously rapid by other standards. One of his 100 projects for Turkey was, we need to build a world-class university here. However, this proved impossible because very few scholars, very few Turks had reached the level where they could be a doctor beyond university faculties, and people from other countries didn't want to come to teach in such a godforsaken place. So one day, Atatürk got a letter from no less than Albert Einstein, who was then living in Princeton, New Jersey. Einstein had been writing letters, I've even seen a photocopy of one of these, to his colleagues in Europe, saying, no, I can't get you a job at Princeton. No, don't bother to apply to any other American universities because they will not hire Jews. Forget about it. Then, for some reason, Einstein writes a letter to Atatürk and says, Hitler has just, they had an act in 1933, all Jews fired from German universities. They are not only fired, but now they're in danger of their lives. We have made a list of 140 highly qualified scholars that are eager to go and work somewhere. He didn't say, and America won't take them, and Europe is too close. Can you take them? And so Atatürk read this over, and he sent back a note saying, have you got more than 140? And so actually, over 200 of the most brilliant minds in Germany emigrated to Turkey, and that became what is now Istanbul University. At a single stroke, one of the world's great Teutonic universities was established in Istanbul with a 95% Jewish faculty. And the people, when you look down the list, the future mayor of Berlin, the guy who revolutionized stage production, the first Freudian analyst ever licensed to practice in a Muslim country, was a woman who brought her Freudian practice, as she's a professor of psychiatry in a German university. She came with this group. So many Jews left Turkey after Israel was founded. The size of the population dramatically decreased. Nonetheless, the two countries had very good relations all during the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s. It was based again on interests. Israel had some benefits to offer Turkey. One is military hardware. They would renovate the Turkish jet fighters and the Turkish tanks. Also, they provided protective coverage for Turkey in Washington. And the Turks are the world's worst lobbyists. I sometimes think that maybe it's an overhang of empire, that when you've been the emperor, you just say, this is our policy, I'm leaving the room now, and you can decide on your own whether you think it's good or not. In the modern world, that doesn't work. You have to be in the room and arguing for yourself. But maybe Turks were born without the PR gene. In any case, Israel willingly took on the pro-Turkey lobbying job in Washington. And as a footnote, they're one of the ones that up until recently made sure that the resolution condemning Turkey regarding the Armenian massacres of 1915 never passed. That's because Israel went to their friends and said, don't bother Turkey. Turkey's our friend. In exchange, one thing Israel got, besides the military contracts, was airspace. Israeli Air Force desperately needs large spaces to practice in, but they don't have any airspace, so they would practice over Turkey. So it was a mutually beneficial relationship. There was even talk of water transfer. Turkey is a water-rich country. Israel, a very water-poor country. Now, this relationship has begun to sour, and I think it is a great object lesson because it previews what you're going to see in the Arab countries when they become more democratic. It is not conceivable, it is not possible that there will be a democratic country, a democratic government in an Arab country that is going to be pro-Israel. Once the majority view of the population is reflected in governments, you're not going to find any government that supports Israeli policies like the policy in the West Bank or in Gaza. So I think this is, again, part of what we're going to be shocked by. We're not just going to be surprised that suddenly women have to wear veils in places where they never had to wear veils before. But we're going to see this kind of a development also. There's not going to be reason for Egypt to be so pro-Israel anymore. And then Jordan only can be pro-Israel because Egypt is. So I think that will start to fade. But I think the relationship, the marriage between Israel and Turkey was never really a love match. It was based on interests. And now it has really started to cool, partly because, I guess the root of it is, the emergence of democracy in Turkey. Turks are, I don't think you find real anti-Semitism or even real anti-Israel sentiment in Turkey, but the Gaza thing in particular has really struck a chord in Turkey. And, you know, we're divorced from it, but they are seeing it every night on TV. Every outrage of, you know, one soldier beating one kid is played over 20 times. It never stops. So the consciousness of how close this is and how humiliating it is to Muslims is brought home very clearly there. So I think that was the beginning of the problem. Gaza invasion had a particular impact on the prime minister of Turkey, because he had been working to bridge the gap between Israel and Syria. And he was, at least by his own account, he seemed to believe he was on the verge of a deal to resolve the Golan Heights issue. And the next day, the Israelis, without telling him, he'd been negotiating with their top leaders, they invaded Gaza. And this made him feel completely betrayed. That's when he had the blow-up with the president of Israel in Davos. It was all over the Gaza issue. Then later came the famous Gaza flotilla episode, in which activists from Turkey tried to break the Gaza blockade. I have spoken not long ago with the Turkish foreign minister. You know, so they had eight Turks killed by Israeli commandos on that ship. And this guy, the foreign minister, said to me, you know, this has never happened in the history of Turkey. We have never had civilians killed by the uniformed soldiers of another country. With all the trouble we had with Russia, all the trouble we had with Greece, this never happened. Now we have eight dead, or nine actually, one's a Turkish-American, nine dead Turkish citizens. And we can't proceed without an apology. Now, this has been the sticking point now, that Israel won't apologize. I've seen in the Israeli newspapers that Netanyahu has actually proposed to the parliament that they do it. But other members of the cabinet refuse. So he's not been able to get this apology issued. I'd like to think that there's a word that means apology in Turkish, but means something different in Hebrew. Isn't that what diplomats are supposed to do? But there have been a number of episodes. They had this crazy episode where the Turkish ambassador was called to the foreign ministry, and they gave him a low chair. The other guy got a very high chair, and they didn't have his flag there, and they lectured him, and this was photographed for TV deputy foreign minister said, we just wanted to show where we are and where those Turks are. These kind of things don't rub the Turks exactly the right way. So that relationship is much tenser now than it has been. And, you know, I lament this because I think it's important for Israel when it wants to have some kind of a bridge out of its isolation. But recently, I did venture to Washington, and I had one guy very much in the Washington establishment who said something I was very surprised by. He said, it's actually good that Turkey's taking this position. He told me, you're wrong when you say they should reconcile. It's better for Turkey to have this position because in the future, Turkey will then have a good position, will have good credentials with the rest of the Muslim world. There will still be a time when Turkey will become the mediator. But that's only possible if Turkey has established its bona fides during this period. That's what it's doing right now. So actually, this is positive. I think on that note, all I want to say in concluding is that I've been on campuses where the sports team is called the Raiders, the Screaming Eagles, the Chargers. We've had enough of that in America. It's great to be in a place where your team is the Diplomats. More power to you. Thank you.